I spend the $5, there isn't any more cost. It's finished. Well, his cost is ex ante, is the term here. It's prospective. Ex ante is a Latin term meaning beforehand. Right? Ex ante is you're looking toward the action, just about to do something, and you're looking ahead of what's going to happen, consequences or the value to you or something. Ex post is looking back, so an accountant looking back, what happened last year, last month. Right? And so costs are only ex ante. Before you spend it, before you spend the money, before you spend your time, whatever the expenditure is, before you make your choices, you have your value scales, you pick what you think is the top value to you, the cost is the second highest value, and the cost disappears after you do it. After you do it, there's no more cost. You can go back and say, well, gee, I shouldn't have done that, or did do that, or something. That's sort of history. It's not cost. So cost is ephemeral and disappears after the action occurs. There's a question, for example, of so-called sunk cost, where, well, for example, businessman spends $10,000 on a product, produces a product. He'd like to sell it for $10,000, or for $12,000, let's say, anticipates a profit of 20% or something. He's already spent the $10,000. The product is there, so we can't sell it for $12,000. Nobody wants to buy it. He sells it for $5,000, let's say. But the point, but if he says to himself, I can't sell it for less than $10,000, then my cost would be excessive. I have to hold on to it and not sell it. It's pretty ridiculous because cost has already disappeared. It's too bad he spent the $10,000, but he's done it already. Now he's stuck with this thing. Now he's to figure what's the most value I can get for it. And so if it's $5,000, it's $5,000. There's no more. The $10,000 cost has already been expended and it's finished. Out the window. He now tries to get what he can get for it. So as a result, they're basing something on costs, or what costs supposedly are as an entity is non-existent. This goes in welfare economics and politics. This is all over the place. For example, economists dealing with government projects will say, should the government do something? Should it build a dam? Or should it build a highway? Or should it build a steel plant? Economists will say, well, you have to engage in a cost-benefit analysis. You take the social benefits, you add it up, put a money figure on it, take the social cost and add them up, put a money figure on that, and if the social benefits are higher than the social cost, you should do it. Government should do this project. If the social costs are higher than the social benefits, you shouldn't do it. Sounds terrific. It's only two problems with it. One, nobody knows what the benefits are. Two, nobody knows what the costs are. Okay? benefits are psychic, subjective to each individual. Costs are also psychic, subjective to each individual. And there's no way to add them up. Even an individual, it'd be tough to add them up because there's no unit. Certainly, between individuals, you can't add them up. So there ain't no such thing as social costs. There ain't no such thing as social benefits because you can't add them up. Outside of that, that's a great theory. Okay. But this is it. This is the main economic prop for most government action now among economists, even so-called free market economists. Well, we add up the social costs, we add up the social benefits to see what's what. And since there are no such thing as social costs and social benefits, because they're not addable and they're ephemeral and all that, that sort of polishes off in 5 minutes. Almost all welfare economics that goes down the drink. Okay. All economic justification for most government action. Of course, sometimes you see that it sounds free market, but sometimes they say, well, we add it up, and it looks like you shouldn't build this dam because the social costs are greater than social benefits. So if you say, well, gee, this guy's pretty good, he's blocking that dam, okay, that's true. On the other hand, he's also justifying the other 90% of stuff that government wants to do. okay, so the... another thing about costs is, looking at it, pure expenses now, just as monetary expenses or costs of how much you have to pay out. The costs themselves are not given. The costs themselves, is another great Austrian insight, are determined by the utility of the value the consumers place on the product. In other words, you have, let's say, here's a product, and entrepreneurs think the consumers will spend $10,000 on it, and say $12,000 is my original example. Therefore, they're willing to pay out $10,000 on wages, labor, rent and material and whatever. Okay. So, this main often, they're willing to pay out the $10,000 because they expect their anticipated consumer demand is $12,000. Otherwise, they wouldn't be paying the $10,000. They expect the consumers would only pay $8,000 for this thing. They would not pay the $10,000. The cost of production, just in terms of money payment, is then determined, is not a fixed item, given God-given somehow, and long-run and eternal. Cost of production is itself a function of how much entrepreneurs think consumers will pay for. So rather than saying that in the long run, prices are determined by cost of production, consumer prices are determined by factor prices, or cost of production in terms of money, quite the opposite. In the long run, cost of production will indeed equal prices, except that the causal factor is the other way around. In the long run, the cost will be determined by how much entrepreneurs think consumers will pay for it. So in the long run, if $10,000 is $10,000 or $12,000, whatever, it's determined by the fact that entrepreneurs will, consumers will pay that amount. So the utility, consumer utility determines cost rather than the other way around. So the causal connection goes individual value scales, utility, demand, price, consumer price, costs. So that in addition to the whole problem of the long run and shifting, and in fact, there is no long run, all the rest of it, another big hole in the neoclassical theory is, which says that in the long run, costs determine prices. It's just exactly the opposite. Utility, consumer utility determines costs as well as price. Now you can see this is very, very, very practical applications. That's many conservatives, businessmen, etc., say that inflation is caused by costs going up. Costs go up, therefore we have to raise prices. This is a typical. This, by the way, the typical PR excuse. Gee, I'm sorry, Mrs. Jones, I have to raise the price of bread, but I have to pay more for it. Otherwise, I'd love to give it to you for next to nothing. So this is essentially PR, but many people believe it, unfortunately. It's actually that the two points to consider here. One is the price is determined by supply and demand, as I've already said. Where does cost come in? Where does cost fit in this business here? It doesn't in that equation. If the supply is this much, the demand is that much, this is what the price will be, as well as what the costs are. The entrepreneurs pay for it. If the price will be, let's say, 80 cents a loaf for Wonder Bread, if the cost of money expenditures, cost and sense of that, go up to a dollar a loaf, they just go out of business. They can't just add on an extra 20 cents. Because if they could add on an extra 20 cents, why do they wait for cost to go up? What does cost got to do with it? They may as well charge a higher price to begin with. Nobody waits for cost to raise prices. If you can raise the price and make a profit out of it, you'll do it to begin with. Yeah?
Good example of that. The computer I bought 6 months ago, I paid $1,200 for it. Mm-hmm. Now I could buy two for the price of one.
Yeah.
And you know what it costs them to produce them?
What?
$20 to $30.
Yeah. And probably other costs of transportation and stuff, packaging, all that. Yeah, you're
salesman.
Right, sure. So it's the other way around. Prices determine costs rather than vice versa. And consider things which have no cost at all, more or less, like Rembrandts. It doesn't cost anybody to produce Rembrandts. Rembrandt's dead already. The painting is there, and yet it has a price. The price shifts. Yeah.
Nice example of that, too, would be something like energy. If the demand for energy goes up, then because the price goes up, the sources of it which are more costly to produce, they start producing, so the cost goes up, too.
Right, exactly. Cost is determined by price. The amount that businessmen are willing to pay for copper is determined by how much copper products will sell among the consumers. So the chain, causal chain, is from the consumers back to the manufacturers, back to raw material. And copper will be more expensive because if the demand for copper products go up, which will then revert back to the increase in demand for copper. So, and this also goes, of course, to unions, because many conservatives, businessmen blame unions for inflation. Well, the inflation because unions jack up wage rates, and therefore we have to increase prices. That's the same sort of thing. The prices go up anyway, or go down anyway, regardless of unions, regardless of wage rates. And secondly, question then asked is, why are entrepreneurs, businessmen willing to pay the higher wage rates? Why don't they say, we can't pay, we'll lose money if we pay it? The fact they're willing to pay it is a sign they're willing to, their costs they're willing to incur are determined by what they think think prices are going to go up, they're willing to pay higher wage rates. So the causal chain is once again that from the consumer. The only time when a cost will impinge on prices is if the supply goes down. Supply goes down, indeed, price will go up. If in some way an increased cost results in a lower price and lower production, a lower supply, then the price will go up. You see this, for example, in...
say that again.
The only time a price will go up from the supply side is if the supply goes down. Of course, going up is not going to do anything unless something happens with the supply also contracts. For example, if the computer business or whatever costs go up and you can't charge a higher price because you already charged the maximum price, which is profitable, then firms go out of business, let's say, they cut back production, and then supply goes down and the price goes up. So it's not the cost that do it, it's the possible drop in supply. If you're looking for causes of inflation, of course, supply doesn't go down. Obviously, production usually goes up every year, in the broad sense. We don't have a situation where every year production goods and services is 10% less than the year before, fortunately, not in that situation. So obviously, it can't be the supply side that causes the problem. And obviously, something in the demand side that's for general increase in prices. Another thing, for example, people tend to think of a sales tax or an excise tax can be just passed on by the businessman, just passed on to the consumer. Well, it doesn't work that way. Isn't that automatic? For example, usually when the price of when the admission tax in movies goes up, very often the movie owners, theater owners, will circulate petitions. Don't fight the tax. Write your city councilman or something against the emission tax. They wouldn't do that. They could just pass it on automatically. Why should they bother? If a tax is simply going to be passed on to the consumer with no other problem, the businessman wouldn't care. The problem is, of course, because it is passed on, the consumer spends less, buys less of it, and you're going up the demand curve. In other words, the supply of movies or theaters is going to go down. It could be hurt of the profit margin is going to go down. So you can't just pass on a price. Okay? You can only do it through a cut in supply. Is what I'm asked to. And nobody wants to cut supply unless because they might be going out of business or they're contracting their business, etc. By the way, on the subject of taxes, it's kind of interesting because at least in the United States, a lot of the tax, there is, of course, very heavy taxes on liquor for various reasons.
Not nearly as heavy as Ontario.
Really?
In the U.S., that's really hurting our convention and tourist business. In the U.S., if you buy a drink in a bar, about 60% of the cost is taxed. In Ontario, it's about 90%.
Taxes on taxes.
That really hurts.
That's unbelievable.
That's hurting.
We go to the States to buy cheap wine.
Wow. And we like your tax.
Amazing. So part of that is revenue, of course, for the government. Part of it is fundamentalism, where liquor is evil, and they make the sinners pay. Part of it comes in from businesses themselves. For example, in the case of the United States, for example, there are fixed taxes on stills. You pay a large fixed amount regardless of the size of the still. And what this does, obviously, is put in by the large liquor manufacturers to shaft their small competitors. If you have a fixed tax, if every liquor producer has to pay, $1 million as a fixed amount, regardless of how much they produce, obviously the small liquor person is forced out of business. And the big liquor people know that full well. For example, the hysteria we have, of course, in the Appalachian Mountains, we have a great tradition of the moonshine, called heroic farmers, moonshiners, out there producing illegal liquor. Now, why is it illegal? It's illegal because they don't pay the still tax, which is enormous, which prevents them from setting up their equipment. So there's a constant fight between the revenuers and the moonshiners. Yeah. I guess that's a good note, moonshiners. Yeah,
yeah,
good.
Moonshiners.
Right.
Okay. Any quick questions before we wrap up the session? There's no such thing as a quick question.
Well, I just have one comment there. This fixed amount of tax, but also various government interference. Yeah. Just the fact that it's the same amount of work for a small company to make out an income tax return as it is for a large company. There are all sorts of these fixed things, and they are what lead very much to the bigness of companies that we have. I don't think that in a free market that there would be so many big companies in proportion to small companies.
That's a big reason. For example, workman's compensation law, which came in 1900, 1910, were put in largely by bigger businesses. And one of the you have to have a certain, you know, all this paperwork and all the rest of it go into it. You want to impose higher costs on their smaller competitors and drive them out of business, awful limits. A lot of that's going on.
Just before we go, does anybody have a preference of our restaurant to recommend here?
Well, I think I want to try to get more discussion here this time. Going onto a more advanced so-called area, obviously it's skipping a lot of stuff in between. And the logical chain. But at any rate, comparing, I want to do a little bit more comparison of Austrian economics with Orthodox economics and the political implications of them as we get going along. Those of you who have taken micro are familiar. Well, for example, there are several motivations for antitrust legislation, antitrust action. And one of them, I'm convinced, which is another story. There's mostly one group of businessmen trying to shaft the other group. And there are now, for example, in the United States, a lot of private antitrust suits. Control data corporation doesn't like IBM, thinks it's too efficient. They file a suit saying it's unfair competition. And they try to restrict them and request them from doing stuff. So there's a lot of that. A lot of the antitrust suits that have been filed over the years by the Department of Justice, Federal Trade Commission, are done to behest of one set of competitors trying to eliminate or cripple the other set. So, in addition to that, there's, and of course, there's also the attorney motivation. One of the ways you achieve fame and fortune in the legal profession in the United States, you become an assistant, you're a young lad out of, nowadays young lass also, out of Harvard Law School, you become attached to the Attorney General Division, Department of Justice. You work up an antitrust suit against, who knows, DuPont or IBM or something. It takes you about 5 years to become one of the world's foremost experts prosecuting IBM or DuPont. But then, lo and behold, you leave the Justice Department, you become a chief attorney for IBM and DuPont fighting a suit. Okay? So this is essentially, of course, a racket. So that's one of the reasons for antitrust prosecutions. This is quite prevalent. Anyway, in the economic sphere, among economic theory, the big, which fits in both the theory and political application, the big, a little bit weakened now, but still the big thing, to read micro textbooks, that's always in there. The big reason for breaking up business, for government regulation, for divesting parts and breaking up firms and all that sort of stuff, is so-called monopolistic competition or imperfect competition or whatever. The competition is not perfect. The competition does not meet the standards by which economics applies to the real world. And it goes basically something like this. This is sort of a standard thing. Another diagram. This is almost, despite all the millions of words that have been written about antitrust, this is basically it. We have dollars, y-axis, quantity produced on the x-axis. You have the so-called average cost curve, which is considered to be U-shaped. Right? I don't know the whole thing on this because I don't agree with cost curves anyway. Basically, it is that the common sense kind of way that if you're building an automobile plant and you have this huge amount of equipment, you got $200 million invested in equipment. If you produce one automobile per year, it's very costly because you're geared for the optimum of 100,000 automobiles a year. If you're only producing one, of course you're $250,000 per car or something like that. So You look at average cost, it starts very high, and as you keep using up the equipment, what really is, in the Austrian view, it really is because of indivisibility. You have different kinds of machinery and buildings in order to really use them in an optimal sense. if you start too low, you're going to be extremely costly per unit. Okay. So, as you keep going, then average cost declines. And finally, you reach a point where everything is sort of used to capacity or whatever. And you wind up average cost turning up, and you get a so-called U-shaped average cost curve. In other words, total cost in terms of dollars per unit produced. the assumption is, by the way, that it's a smooth arc. In addition to various other problems, average cost. This is the fact that you don't know what the cost is because, for one thing, costs depend on time horizon. If you're going to produce something over a two-year period, cost will be one set of curves. If you produce over a five-year period, another set of curves. You have a whole bunch of things going on which can't be incorporated into this. At any rate, you don't know, not only that, including everything else, just like you don't know the demand curve is any kind of particular shape, you don't know what the shape of this thing is. It doesn't have to be a smooth arc. All you know is it falls at one point, it finally reaches the bottom somewhere, and then it goes up. That's all. Okay. It could be anything. It could be something like that. It could be something like this. It could be jagged. Something, whatever. But making it a smooth arc leads to very seemingly simple questions, seemingly trivial, makes these all sorts of implications. You make it a smooth arc so you can get a tangency. You can't get a tangency to get something like that. What's a tangent? All right. At any rate, so that's the firm. All right, that's the average cost curve for the firm, business firm. Then you've got the demand curve. According to, I've already talked about this falling demand curve, right? Demand curve always fall. According to neoclassical, Malthusian, current mainstream orthodox theory, it's true that the demand curve of the industry falls, but in the true, correct, proper competition, what they call perfect competition, perfect or pure. Notice the loaded terminology here. These are economists who claim to be value-free, totally value-free, no political implications, moral implications. They use the word perfect, to me indicates that it's good. Okay? Imperfect seems to be bad. All right, so they. At any rate, perfect competition is when the demand curve for each firm is horizontal, perfectly totally horizontal like that. Now, if you look at this thing, if you really analyze it, it's totally ridiculous, because how can you have a horizontal demand curve? The implication is if you have the famous example is the wheat industry. You have each farmer is so small compared to the rest of the industry that he has no impact on the price of wheat. In other words, he can multiply his product almost infinitely, maybe even infinitely, still have no impact on the total supply of wheat. Therefore, whatever he does, the demand curve for his particular wheat will be horizontal. And one of the problems with this is that, if the angel Gabriel comes down to him and says, Zeke, I love you, and therefore I'll be able to multiply your wheat by 2 billion-fold. So instead of, whatever bushels of acre you're getting 3 billion times that, he will have an impact on it. Wheat market. Doesn't matter if he's a small farmer. Okay, so it's not really horizontal. Maybe slightly like that or something like that. As soon as you get that kind of, as soon as you enter any kind of qualification in this thing, the whole theory is shot. I'll show you why in a minute. The assumption is that the horizontal, why do they assume that a horizontal, small wheat farm, teeny little wheat farm has a horizontal demand curve for Zeke's wheat. On the other hand, every other firm in the real world has a falling demand curve, because any firm, whether it's IBM or even whatever, Control Data or anything, will have some kind of impact. Wheaties, Wonderbread, if they keep producing more of it, they'll have to cut their price. They have an impact on the market, big enough. Yeah.
This may seem like a silly question, but why aren't you talking about the supply curve? You're talking about these guys producing more or less. Does that affect the supply?
Yeah, it increases supply, sure. I don't think the supply curve, I don't think there is a supply curve. So before, except in a very long run sense. That's one reason I don't know about. But it increases the supply of the product. It shifts the vertical line to the right when you get all these. But if you have a They have a firm which is infinitely small compared to the industry. They have 20,000 wheat farms. Each wheat farm is teeny. Then you might get something like, in theory, you get something like horizontal anchor for each wheat farm. Anything else is evil. Why is it evil? Why is it inefficient? They have a larger firm which does have an impact on this market. And here is the, this, my friends, is the reasoning behind it. This is why the impetus of economics from the 30s until fairly recently was you should try to break up industries so that they approach the level of a small wheat farm. Break up firm. You have a, if you have a slowly arcing average cost curve, it's the same given the firm, right? Given the firm, important, firm X, producing widgets. If it has a horizontal demand curve, like that, this average price, this means the average price is $10 a widget. The average cost is $8 a widget. Makes a profit of $2 a widget. All right? In equilibrium, this is not the market equilibrium we're talking about. This is a different kind of equilibrium. This is a totally different kettle of fish. This is long-run equilibrium. Long-run equilibrium is such, which the economy is supposedly in, not only tending to it, but in, according to the orthodox economics. In long-run equilibrium, nobody makes any profits. Nobody makes any losses, because there's no uncertainty. Everything, it frees the economy, it frees the data. It frees value scales, which remain frozen forever. It frees resources, it frees technology. And that's it, it frees everything. And then you wind up, if you do that, there's no uncertainty. If everybody knows in their heart, and their gut, and their mind, that everything will be exactly the same 2,000 years from now as it is now, the same value, the same production, the same knowledge, everything, then you will have, you'll wind up fairly soon, in what's called finally general equilibrium. This is Walrasian general equilibrium theory. The Mises is called the evenly rotating economy. Because there's no uncertainty, everybody adjusts the situation, everybody knows what, everybody knows for 2 million years or whatever, everybody's certain, you know, X amount of TV sets going to be purchased, X amount of washing machines, it's all fixed. It's all freeze frozen on Angel Gabriel. And so you wind up then with a tangency. Okay, the magnificent heroic tangency occurs at zero profits. How do you, and zero, how do you make zero profits? Zero profits means your total revenue is equal to your total cost. Okay, total money expended is the same as total money taken in. If total revenue is equal to total cost, then by definition, average revenue, which is total revenue divided by the amount you produce, okay, X, is the same as average cost. Average revenue is the same thing as the demand curve. Demand curve is the amount per total revenue per quantity, same thing as the price. Say. If, in other words, you sell, you produce 10 widgets, produce 1,000 widgets for, and sell it for $10 a widget, you're getting $10,000 in. Your total revenue is 10,000. Your number of widgets is 1,000. Therefore, this is the same thing as the price, which is $10 per widget. All right, so in equilibrium, in final and general equilibrium, this is not market, this is not day-to-day equilibrium, this is never land, which we'll see in a minute, never exists, never can exist, never will exist. In this situation, where everything is frozen forever, you will have each firm with price equal to average cost. All right, if this thing is set, it's a beautiful, it's a setup, okay? If you have a horizontal demand curve for each firm, the only place you can be tangent is right at the bottom. If the same firm is an imperfect, monopolistic competition, which by definition means that it faces a falling demand curve, there's only one place you can be tangent to it. It's falling, right? It's falling demand curve, whatever it's falling, has to be tangent somewhere over here. Yeah? So, in final equilibrium, and then these guys say, aha, you see? What do we conclude from this? We conclude from this as follows. If a firm in the economy is a perfect competition, which is this, by definition, perfect, its production will be higher and its price will be lower than if it's an imperfect or monopolistic competition. QED, end of the analysis. Therefore, consumers are being shafted by imperfect competition of the real world. They would benefit if every firm was so tiny that they were being a perfect competition. That is the conclusion. That's the basis for antitrust legislation and all the rest of them. Now, there are many holes in this argument. Maybe you can supply me some of the holes before I give them my blockbuster conclusion. See any holes in this line of reasoning?
I didn't understand how you get the definition of perfect as horizontal.
It's just called perfect.
Dark perfect.
Yeah, it's called perfect. One of the reasons, because the knowledge is perfect, by the way. You have perfect knowledge. You know what your demand curve is, you know what your cost curves are, you know what...
Perfect. It's more. You need perfect mobility of people.
Perfect mobility, right.
Well, for one thing, I mean, this will never exist. I mean, no further demand curve is going to be horizontal no matter what.
Precisely.
So everybody is imperfect to some small extent, so everybody is getting behind.
And this gives the excuse for the... You set up an ideal, a supposed ideal of perfection, which the market is failing to achieve, and therefore the government then is supposed to have a rationale for stepping in and trying to create these perfect conditions.
And then once again, they've got the good word.
Yeah, great word.
Right? The other thing will be that a large firm will not necessarily have the same cost curve as a small firm.
Ah, okay. Step number one. Who says that these curves are equal? Okay. Who says the cost curve, the average cost curve of a small firm is the same as a large firm? Totally bananas. If we broke up, Schumpeter had a great analysis of this in Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, which is a very interesting book. He was not a libertarian, a free market person. He had very interesting things to say. And he wasn't an Austrian either. He was a Schumpeterian. At any rate. And essentially, one of the things he said was this. Okay, folks, let's assume you're right. Let's assume that in the present state of evil imperfection, we're up here instead of down here. But suppose you try to take General Motors and break it up. Trying to make it perfect. Trying to make it so that, break it up in teeny little pieces so that each one would be, have a horizontal demand curve. You have like 500,000 teeny little firms, each of which has a cost curve, however, way the hell up here, because you're not taking advantage of large scale production. So even though the consumers have a wonderful benefit of being down here on the bottom of this thing, they'd be paying a hell of a lot more for much less. Okay? So let's hooker number one. Who says that the cost curves would be the same? In fact, the reason why there is a big, larger business in many cases is because the cost curves are lower. You're taking advantage of large-scale production and indivisibility. You're able to buy, get a bigger machine and stuff like that. So that's, okay, that's hooker number one.
Does this allow new businesses to enter the market?
I think it's all frozen here.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It would require that everybody has to consume exactly the same amount that they do now.
Likewise.
And not produce any more net people in the world at a net consumable level of their lives.
There's no innovation, there's no discoveries.
Nothing.
Things are given, as the textbooks say. We have given demand curves, given cost curves, given products. And everything, all what real competition is really about, which is trying to find out what's going on, which is trying to beat out the other guy, which is trying to find out, invent new things, outcompete the other guy. All this is tossed aside because you have perfect knowledge. Everybody knows the demand curve, everybody knows the product, everybody knows the cost curve, and then you're grinding this stuff out.
Even this, such a simple thing as equipment wearing out,
would
throw this thing right out the window.
The assumption is
the standard of living would just keep going like this.
Oh, the assumption is the equipment is replaced automatically, so at the same rate that it's
the exact perfect time.
Exact perfect.
Not only are the cost curves different for different companies, as was pointed out, but the effect of the free market will tend to produce the lowest cost curves for companies. And so if you break people up and are interfered with in any way, you're going to raise, you'll get higher cost curves, and therefore you'll get these equilibrium points for each individual company higher up.
Right.
What will just happen because of scale of the economy will be that the cost curves with the imperfect competitors will be lower. And they'll still be imperfect. The public, but the price will still be lower.
Exactly. You have this sort of situation. Let's assume you're here, and you have the perfect competitors to be teeny little firms that are on the bottom, whatever their cost curve is, what's way the heck up there. That's precisely it. Yeah.
If the cost curve is not smooth, you might hit tendencies more than bumps.
Precisely. Now we come on this. Who says this? Who says these curves are smooth? Nobody says. No evidence for any of this stuff. Again, the quality. What we know is qualitative, but they try to assume is quantitative. There's no evidence that has to be like this. Supposing, for example, this is one of my favorite things. Look at the cost curve is a little bumpy, like something like that, then it only hits a tangency on here. You know, you can easily construct a situation where the falling demand curve is just as tangent at the same spot as the horizontal one. Only needs a little twist here. And as I say, there's no evidence for any of this stuff. In fact, why think it's smooth? It's just, you know.
Well, the exact opposite of what somebody just mentioned. Wouldn't they say, well, if you had General Motors and if it ended up being the only car company, then of course there's supposedly no limit on their prices.
Well, that's something else. That's not the cost problem. See, that's a little different. That's now you're dealing with the real world where you're not assuming zero profits and zero losses.
Oh, okay.
That's another. But that's an interesting area. That's that whole cartel thing is that we should go into it because it's important anyway.
There's two other things.
Sure.
One of them is
okay, we'll get back to that.
You know, assuming people are prepared to work for zero profit.
Yeah, that's right.
And I can't see how, if they're only small companies, people are prepared to work for zero profit.
Why indeed are they working for zero profit? Well, they try to get around that. The two wings of thought, Schumpeter himself thought, and in general equilibrium, there'd be zero profit. I don't know why you even maintain your capital at zero profit. Why you just won't let the whole thing run down. The more rational view of it was that the profit would be long run rate of interest, just enough, 3%, 6%, whatever, just enough to keep maintaining the capital. And so you'd have wages of management, which I'll take into consideration. You'd have interest payments.
Suppose it's owner managed.
Huh?
Suppose it's owner managed.
But yeah, but you can conceptually.
Using it with the real world, right?
Yeah, well, you can conceptually separate it out. See, in other words, you say, well, here the guy owns his own firm. You say, well, part of his returns are wages to his management. Part of his interest on his capital investment. You can sort of separate that. It's different, obviously very difficult to do in practice. Conceptually, you can say, okay, he's got his labor management, whatever that is, and he's got the capital investment. But see, the capital investment is very different here. You're assuming no change. Everything's certain. Capital investment, then, is pure time preference. It's the interest is then a function of the fact you have to wait. Is important. But you cut out profits and losses, which is the entrepreneurial part, right, which is the other. Well, Austrians adopted this from Frank Knight, and in some ways wasn't Austrian. And that if you take the return on business firms on investment, there are two parts to it. There's a return for waiting, for just simply for, well, for waiting in the sense of, well, two things. One is the capitalist provides to the workers and the landowners, the other factors of production. It's important service. They, let's say, have a certain productivity. They would get their return. Let's put it this way. Let's say you have corporations which are owned by the workers, the consumer producers co-ops owned by workers and landlords. If they did that, they would get, let's say they get the same payment. Forget about differences in management and entrepreneurship. They would get, let's say they get the same, whatever, I guess $10,000 a year, get it. But he has to wait 3 years or 6 years, whatever, for the product to come rolling off the assembly line before he gets it. You have to wait if you have no paycheck until the money comes in. Essentially, that's what happened in Yugoslavia, which are more or less worker-owned firms. They have to wait, which is a tough proposition. Many people don't have the capital, they don't want to wait. The capitalist provides, even in a world without uncertainty, the capitalist provides the savings to provide the money to pay them now before the 3 years. They don't have to wait. For this service, the workers, in a sense, pay him the capitalist a discount. They pay him the time preference discount. They pay him 6%, 8%, whatever. They're happy to do that because they're getting money now instead of having to wait 3 to 6 years for it. That's the time preference, right? Really, our interest. Where you have a we're essentially in a time part in a time market. This is one of the contributions of Austrians, by the way. Interest is not just a loan; it's the whole profit system. Interest pervades the whole capitalist system or market system. On a loan, it's very easy to see this, right? And by the way, more on interest. The creditor, okay, let's say, gives to the debtor. An exchange, or the creditor gets the debtor right now, say $10,000, and he, in return for an IOU, saying, I will pay you whatever, $11,000 a year from now. Okay, so, these two, what the, so what the creditor is doing is giving the debtor command over immediate resources. He can use the money right now, which is what he wants. The debtor wants to pay stuff, buy stuff, invest it, whatever. So this is a present good. Most things call a present good. It's something which is, this money is useful right now. On the other hand, this IOU is a future good. It's only, the creditor can only get cash it in or start using the money a year from now. So this. So the creditor is exchanging $10,000 present money for future money, present good for future good. Because present good, because of time preference, which everybody has, in different ratios, everybody prefers money now to money later, in the time market, which is worked out between creditors and debtors, or between everybody when they have time preference, a certain rate comes out, let's say 8%, 6%, 10%, whatever, in this case 10%, where both parties agree in this time preference price that they will pay a discount, a premium of 10% for present good or a discount 10% future good. So in other words, the payment of interest is a payment for time preference. Interestingly enough, the Catholic Church, the scholastic philosophers, are extremely bright economists. They worked out a lot of the stuff I've been talking about, a lot of utility theory, a lot of market analysis. They were very pro-free market, as a matter of fact. And it's amazing, in many cases, a lot of these guys were Franciscan monks who were living in a hut somewhere, in a cave somewhere for 50 years. They worked out very sophisticated analyses of the market. And the one thing they couldn't hack, the one thing they couldn't understand is time preference. In other words, they could understand about risk, they understood about uncertainty and profit, they all feel that, right? They couldn't understand why it's legitimate, moral, licit, to earn an interest on a pure loan, just a pure loan, no other, nothing else attached. And they couldn't, therefore they concluded it was sinful and evil, opposed to natural law, and outlawed it. All interest was outlawed by the Catholic Church for centuries, 1,000 years. And it was really tragic because it meant that nobody, after a while, after about the 18th century or so, and everybody, of course, everybody came in favor of interest, they didn't understand about time preference. They more or less realized interest was important. These usury laws, they were called, were discredited the scholastic economics altogether. These guys are nutty. And the whole concept, the whole analysis went out the window. The baby was thrown out with the bathwater, so to speak. And it's too bad. They understood about risk and opportunity cost and all that. And so they understood that you could make 20% by investing in some kind of sea voyage. It's okay to charge 20% for a loan because then you're giving up the other 20% you would have gotten. All that sort of stuff, very sophisticated. They couldn't understand a pure loan. They never grasped about time preference. Time preference, by the way, was the discovery of Bombard, I mentioned before, 1880s. And before that, well, some people, Turgot was a really great guy, he's been forgotten. Pre-French Revolution statesman. And basically, these were people really copper riveted why interest is charged, why it's explainable, why it's understandable, why it's moral, if you want to put it that way, et cetera, et cetera, and why it's being done. Otherwise, it was always assumed that somehow the creditor was ripping off the debtor, one way or the other. It was never explained why the debtor wanted to agree to pay this, by the way. It was one of the hitches in the argument. So we see how this works in a pure loan, but as Bombard pointed out, Fetter, the great American Austrian pointed out afterward, Frank Fetter, unfortunately, generally neglected magnificent value of price and general market theorist, that this whole thing pervades the economy. If you take, for example, forgetting about a loan for a minute, here's a capitalist so what does he do? He buys, he saves up money, okay, by not spending it. Saves up money. He then pays workers, landlords, or whatever, for their production, right, for their productive services. So he is paying them, let's say he pays some worker $10,000. This is the employer now, the capitalist. And the employee gets the money, and he gets, the employee gives the employer the labor services which then incorporate into the product, so to speak, helping to transform the product eventually sold. So if it's, let's say it's worth $12,000, in other words, the amount the employee produces, so-called marginal product, the whole question of how you get to that, assuming that, employer pays him, say, $10,000 because, and the employee is willing to accept it because the employer is getting it, the employee is getting it right now. He doesn't have to wait 5 years to get it. And so what's happening is the employer is providing a present good. The employee is giving the employer a future good, which the employer will reap, you know, after the thing is produced and sold. So what happens is you have a vast time market, which is good, where the employer is essentially the creditor, not legally, but economically. The employee is the debtor. He's getting the money, he's getting the present good now. The employee pays the employer the same sort of interest return. It's called natural interest, like Barber, that the debtor pays the creditor. And in the long run, the tendency is towards making these things be equal. Of course, it never reaches equality, but also some other things happen. The tendency is to have a similar rate in one area and the other. Because if you can earn 20% in one place and 5% in another place, people have to shift out of the 5% into the 20%. It tends toward equalization. It never gets there. That's the long-run equilibrium. It tends toward it.